morning, we are going to talk about the final one of the five hindrances, and that is the hindrance of... Hang on. What is it? I'm not sure. Is it this? No. Are you sure? The hindrance of doubt. Okay. Now, doubt is an interesting one because doubt is not... always a bad thing. For example, when the people of Kalama came to the Buddha and said, Bhante, all of these different teachers come here and they all teach us something different, and we're confused and we're doubtful and we don't know what's right and what's wrong. And the Buddha said to them, you are doubting about a doubtful matter. Right? He didn't say to them, don't have any doubts. He didn't say it's wrong for you to doubt. It's appropriate in that context to doubt. And, I mean, we can sympathize with them. I mean, it must have been terrible. The information overload they were suffering in those days must have been hard for them to deal with, right? Luckily, we've managed to solve that problem today. Or have we? Anyway, so... it's appropriate to doubt, and when you hear different people saying different things, then it's appropriate to hold them in suspension and to be not sure. And one of the sure signs of a fool is that they always know what's what, and they always know what's right and what's wrong. And a wise person has plenty of doubts, and they have plenty of doubts about things that they don't know about. So, how are we to know the difference? What kind of doubt is appropriate or in what circumstances, and what kinds of doubt are not appropriate and in what circumstances? Well, many years ago, I was staying in northern Thailand, and I was very lucky to stay in a hut in the middle of a forest, and I stayed there for a year. And in that hut in the middle of the forest was looked after by a local businessman, and he was a very kind of doubting character, and he always used to struggle with doubt about everything that he did. And I always remember he built himself a kuti, it was like a teak plantation I was staying on, and he built a kuti there I was staying in, and he built another kuti on the property for himself to come and stay and do some meditation from time to time. But, you know, you could see that whole kind of project was characterized by this kind of doubt. So, for example, the kuti that he built for himself, bottom floor of it was like a concrete pad with a big door that was open up to the kuti, right? It's a very unusual design, right? And then the top floor was it's just a single room downstairs and a single room upstairs where he would stay. And I was looking at this design and thinking, why do you build a kuti with a ground floor, concrete floor, and like a door that opens up the whole way? I said, why did you build the kuti like that? And he said, oh, it's so I can park my Harley underneath. So he can make sure that he doesn't have to make the choice between his Dharma practice and his Harley Davidson. So, okay, fair enough. And then the first night he actually came and stayed in that kuti. He came to me the next day and he said, oh, he was so proud that he managed to come and stay and practice that night. And I said, oh, why is that? And he said, because last night it was such a struggle to come and to this kuti and meditate. You know, it was one of the hardest decisions he's ever had to make because Man U was playing Liverpool. But he managed to overcome it. And which is more important? Oh, come on, it's Man U playing Liverpool, but I was going to go and do some meditation. So that was like a big struggle for him. So his life, he had a lot of these kinds of issues. And I remember once we drove to Chiang Mai, and we were on our way back. And driving down this unfamiliar road, and the road sort of driving down straight, and then it forked off in two directions. And we were sort of driving, and he was sort of driving and slowed down a bit and wobbled a bit, and then just went straight down the middle. And we're just kind of stuck in the grass on the middle, like, well, oh, we don't know what to do. So sometimes you go either left or right, one or the other, and you don't know. So one of the things in English, they have this very unreliable idiom. Like, English is full of idioms and sayings that are just obviously untrue. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. I mean, come on, are you a human being? That's ridiculous. And then you have many hands make light work, and also too many cooks spoil the broth. So which one is it? I forgot my place. Now I'm doubting. Where was I? We were doubting. Oh, that's right. Hindsight is 20/20. Right? Hindsight is 20/20. Do you know what that means? Hindsight is like 20/20 vision. So when afterwards you can look back. Is there a saying in German for that, or French? Hindsight is 20/20. See, it's much more sensible. See, in English you have all these sayings that are just not true. So we say hindsight is 20/20. Okay? Right? It means after you don't know before you make a decision how it's going to turn out, but afterwards you know, right? But that's completely ridiculous. Of course you don't know afterwards, because after you've made a decision, all you know is what the outcome of that decision was. You don't know what would have happened if you'd made the other decision. Yeah? That's the problem. Yeah? If you choose to go left, you know what left is like, but you still don't know what right is like, so you're still no better off as to knowing what was the right decision. So even after you've made the decision, you never know if it was the right one. Yeah? And yet, somehow, I mean, we are put into this very weird world, right? We grow up, we're born into this world as kids, okay? Here we are, we're babies, we grow up, we're like, hello, where am I? What am I doing here? And no one can tell you that. You're just here. What's the purpose of my life? No one can tell you that. Okay, go to school. Okay, fine. Okay, we're learning maths now. Oh, are we? What's maths? Okay, 1 + 1 = 2. Why am I learning this? No one's going to tell you why you're not. It'll be useful for you. You have to learn it. Okay. You know, and then you have to spend the next 10 years of your life learning this stuff. All right. I'll sort of take it on faith. People kind of know what they're doing. And then you finish school and you've been told all your life, you do this and you do that. And then you go to university and you're like, okay, do what you like. What do you want to do? And they're like, what do I want to do? I've got no idea. I mean, why is this? It's completely crazy. We expect kids who are like 17 or something to be able to know what they want to do for the rest of their life. I mean, it's nuts. So, nothing ever turns out the way that you think, right? I mean, I'll tell you just the story of me and my mates when we graduated. So my two best friends, Stuart, he graduated, went to university, got an engineering degree. Got his master's, did a couple of years working engineering, went to England, helped to design the Channel Tunnel, and I told him, you have to tell me which bits that you designed, so I'll make sure I avoid those bits. And when he got back from England, I said, how was your stay in England? What did you do? He said, well, it was mostly falling asleep on public transport. There was one time he fell asleep and when he woke up, there's a bunch of guys on the other side of the train carriage were just giggling and looking at him. He didn't know what they were doing, so he stood up and just like immediately fell over, and they'd tied his shoelaces to the seat while he was asleep. Anyway, it's my friend Stuart. So he got back to Australia and he enrolled to do a law degree. And I'm like, why are you doing law? He said, because I don't like engineering. And I'm like, do you like law? No. So that's one way of doing it. My other friend, Gary, he fell in love when he was just out of high school, got married and started having babies. So he didn't go to university. He had to go and start working to earn money for his family. And we're like, you know, he's like 17, a 17-year-old bride. And we're like, dude, like, what are you doing? Right? And he got a job working as a bank teller. And this was like, this is terrible for him because he was like, he's like a really kind of sporty, outdoorsy character. And he loves doing kind of adventurous things and so on. And there he is working at the most kind of boring job in a bank that you could possibly imagine with a wife and a kid at 17. I mean, this is not going to end well. Yeah? I met him a few years ago. He was still happily married to his wife with a big family, and he quit his bank job years ago, and now he works doing underwater photography and teaching scuba diving. So that's how it turned out for him. Stuart's still a lawyer. So what do you do? How do you choose? We don't teach people how to choose things, and yet we expect them to choose how to live their life. We just stumble through it. You know, I mean, I didn't know what to do, so I went to university and I thought I'd do some philosophy. I thought, oh, maybe I'll learn what I want. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I thought, ah, what I want is to drop out and go play rock and roll. So that's what I did. So how do we know what our choices are and where they're going to lead us? We don't. Yeah? And yet we have to make them anyway. And so this is the essence of doubt, is this mind that you want to know beforehand, is this going to be right? And so many times people come to me and they say, is this right? You know, my meditation, I'm meditating like this, is this right? Is this correct? Well, like, there's no such thing as correct meditation. I mean, there might be some things you say, well, this is not really advisable, or this is probably not going to be very helpful. But you have to find out your meditation for yourself. You know, but people want that kind of reassurance. I mean, they want some support on their path. And that's perfectly understandable. It's perfectly fine. But it's just that at a certain point, we have to realize, well, we don't really know. And a search for certainty is going to be somewhat doomed. In science, we get used to, if from a kind of a layman's perspective of science, we get sort of used to the idea that science is very kind of accurate and very precise. And, you know, if we want to weigh something, then we assume that we can weigh something very accurately. If we want to make a building, for example, we know we can make a building and have a very, very large probability that the building isn't going to fall down because we trust the engineering. And we can fly airplanes and they fly in the sky every day with a high degree of reliability. So we get used to the idea that science is something that is very accurate and very precise. But, of course, once you start looking at science, you realize that science is all about probabilities. There's no such thing in the real world as being able to measure something precisely. We measure things to within a certain degree of accuracy, and then there's a certain degree of probability as to what the outcome is. But there's no such thing as absolute truth and confidence, even in sciences. And even when we come to basic things like, say, basic axioms, like in geometry, they say a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. And we learned this at primary school as basic geometry. In fact, it's not really true. And Einstein pointed out that gravity curves the universe and curves space-time, so that the shortest distance between two points is, in fact, a curve. Now, to assume that it's a straight line is good enough for most things, right? unless we're plotting a space travel to Mars, then we probably can ignore the curvature of space-time. But it's just an approximation. And so we have in our minds, we have this need for certainty, and yet at the same time, the kind of information and the kind of knowledge that the world gives us, even in those fairly simple and well understood things, is never certain. And if even in the area of geometry and physics, then the knowledge still has that degree of uncertainty and approximation to it, how much more so is that the case when it comes to the mind? And when it comes to the mind, our knowledge is of a much different nature. Our knowledge is much more vague, much more shifting, much more uncertain. And when we come to the Dhamma in particular, and to early Buddhist teachings in particular, then it's easy to get overwhelmed by what I think is like a false sense of confidence in what the teachings are saying. And, of course, I believe that there's something that's deeply true in what the Buddha's teachings are saying. At the same time, you know, we can't help but notice that when it comes to, say, interpretations of particular teachings, that there are many different interpretations. And the problem that the Kalamas raised to the Buddha hasn't gone away. Even if you're a Buddhist, there's still lots of different interpretations. Even if you're a Theravada Buddhist, there's lots of different interpretations. Even if you follow early Buddhist teachings and just want to read what's in the suttas, then there's still lots of different interpretations. So you don't kind of eliminate doubt in this way. And when I was in Sri Lanka earlier in the year, there was a group of people there who're having problems in Sri Lanka these days because there is a lot of sort of cultish and conspiratorial movements who are sort of proposing these very kind of wacky kind of teachings and things like that. So some of them teach things like that, you know, anicca doesn't mean impermanence, or they teach things like that the Buddha was really born in Sri Lanka and so on and so forth. So there's these kind of nutty ideas which gain quite a lot of credence because people don't have much education as to the facts. And so, you know, people in the government and elsewhere have become concerned by this, and they've been trying to sort of counter it. But one of the ways that they've tried to counter it is by saying, well, what we need is like one authoritative version of the scripture. Like, if we can fix the Pali canon and make one version of it that everyone agrees on, then that'll solve the problem. We can just refer to that. And I'm like, no, that is not going to work, right? This is just this fundamentalist idea that you can somehow fix knowledge. Not only will it fail, but it's a completely misguided venture. Spiritual practice doesn't come from a sense of certainty as to what the facts are. It's not from whether you're correct or incorrect. Sure, there are some ways of being incorrect that are going to harm your spiritual practice. Yeah, of course, right? If you believe that, you know, hunting elephants in your spare time is no obstacle to meditation practice, well, you're probably mistaken and you should stop doing that, right? So there are certain things that you should stop doing. But on the other hand, within the spectrum of what is Dhamma, then there are many different approaches to things, and it's not always the case that things are right or wrong. And this is not just something that I'm saying from the perspective of, you know, 2,500 years of Buddhist tradition. It's something we find within the suttas themselves, and the multiple occasions within the suttas where the monks will be sitting around and discussing a particular verse or a particular passage, and they'll all give their different interpretations on that. For example, another case where somebody went round to ask about meditation, how they should meditate, from different teachers, and then they asked Venerable Sariputta, and then Sariputta gives a really kind of long and complicated answer, and then he asked Venerable Ananda, and he gave this kind of nice verse or something like that, and he went to Mahakasapa, and I can't remember what Kasapa did, he probably just grunted at him and scowled, and then he comes back to the Buddha and says, well, these people are teaching me different things. And the Buddha said, well, they're all teaching about how they attained Nibbana. By the way, I was joking about Mahakasapa grunting and scowling. I don't really think he was like that, but that's the kind of the impression that you get in the tradition sometimes. And then this is where he used the very famous simile of the blind men and the elephant. So if you have an elephant and some blind men are coming up to it, and one will feel the leg and say, this is a pillar. One will feel the ear and say, oh, it's a fan. One will feel the trunk and say, this is a hose or something like that. You'd think to be honest, that they'd probably be able to smell that it was an elephant. But anyway, let's just for the sake of the story, let's just assume that that's what happened. And so the Buddha is saying, well, they're actually, you know, each of them is right in their own way, but they're all telling you a part of the truth or a perspective on the truth. Now, so what does that mean for us, and what does that mean for when we're meditating? Well, partly what it really means is, what do you want? That's the decisive factor. The decisive factor is not, is this correct or is this not correct? The decisive factor is, what do you want? Okay? So if there's an elephant, and if what you want is to not be crushed by the elephant's feet, then it probably doesn't really matter which part of the elephant that you touch. As long as you know that it's an elephant, then you can stay out of its way. That's the point. Right? On the other hand, if what you want to do is maybe harness the elephant and put it to work hauling logs, not that I endorse such behavior, I don't think we should be using elephants for that, just for the record, but if you were, then, you know, then your approach to the elephant would be different. So this is the thing. In Buddhism, knowledge is pragmatic. And in that respect, I believe that the Dhamma is also the same as in science. So in science, if I'm, let's say I am in the Indian Space Agency and we are building a rocket to go to Mars, all right? Did everybody know that? Did you know that the Indians sent a rocket to Mars? Yes, some people know that. Did everyone know that? Yes, some people don't know that. I find it extraordinary. The Indians a few years ago made a rocket and sent it to Mars to do, and they just sort of flew by Mars and they did some testing and things like that. And it cost them about $70 million to do that. Okay? So that's about half of what it takes Hollywood to make a movie about going to Mars. And one of the reasons that I always remember that is because my favorite photo is the photo of when the mission was successful, and there's a photograph from the inside of the Indian Space Agency, and it's all of these women in saris who are jumping up in the air and hugging each other, yeah? And they were the rocket scientists who sent the mission to Mars. It's fantastic. Anyway, so if I was one of them, and I was wanting to send the rocket to Mars, then it's a very delicate operation, and there's all of the engineering to be considered, and then there's all of the, like, the ignition temperature of the fuel, and how long is it going to burn for, and what's the thrust going to be, and where do you orientate it, and the influence of gravity. You have to take general relativity into account. General relativity or special relativity? Anyway, you have to take relativity into account. And they had to time it very precisely. They could only do it because of the particular match of the orbits of the Earth and Mars. So you could kind of slingshot the rocket at just one particular orbit. And if you just got it a tiny little bit out of the way, then it would just go way off into space and completely miss it. So they had very little tolerance for error. But they managed to do it. And they managed to get it within that very, very narrow window. So even in that circumstance where everything has to be so refined and so precise, you're still dealing with approximations. It has to be within a certain degree of tolerance to actually get by at that particular point. And that's the amount of truth that you need. So the same thing is in Buddhism. It's not, is this absolutely true or not? This is where we get mistaken. We think that the Dhamma is true, therefore we have this idea of absolute truth. And when we have this idea of absolute truth, we've gone too far. The Buddha never talked about ultimate truth or absolute truth. These are ideas we find in later Buddhist philosophy, but not in the suttas. Klaus, we were talking about ideas you only find in the Abhidhamma and so on. This is another one, ultimate truth, right? And ultimate truth means... I don't even want to get into it, but the Buddha talked about was a pragmatic truth. Does the Dhamma actually get you to Mars? Huh? Or more likely, does it help you to let go of suffering? That's how much truth you need. Huh? And actually, you need even less truth than that. You don't need all of the truth. You don't even need to know, will this let me go, help me let go of suffering? Will this help me to let go of this suffering or of this attachment? Right? This thing in my mind now is causing me to suffer. How much knowledge do I need to know to help me let go of this thing? That's how much we need. Yeah. And again, just like science, right? A scientist who's going to send a rocket to Mars doesn't need to master everything about the science that's getting to Mars. They have a particular job, and the particular job of that particular scientist or that particular engineer is to work out what pressure on this nozzle is going to be necessary to open that in order to send the fuel down that line at appropriate speed. That's the problem that they need to solve. So the number one way to overcome doubt is to limit the scope of the problem. We don't need to solve everything. We don't need to figure everything out. Just what's in front of us. Yeah? And if you're doubting, is this the right way of practicing? Is this what I should be doing? Maybe I should be doing it. Then just ask yourself, where am I suffering? What's the suffering that's actually I'm creating now? And where is the attachment that's leading to that suffering? The Dhamma that you need right then is the Dhamma that can help you to address that suffering. And when you do that and you see that Dhamma work to address that suffering, that gives you the confidence. Again, just like in science or just like in engineering, you have the proposal, you build the thing, it gets to Mars. That's what tells you that you got your sums right. Yeah. When you meditate and you let go of that suffering, that's how you know. That's how you overcome doubt. So if you find yourself being plagued by doubt a lot, then there's really kind of two extremes here. The most obvious one is if you find yourself being plagued by doubt a lot, constantly worrying, double-guessing yourself and these kinds of things, then reduce your scope, consciously reduce your scope. Don't deny those doubts, because it's not wrong to doubt. It's just wrong to let yourself get led astray by doubts. And just say to yourself, what is the problem I need to deal with right now? What's the most urgent thing within the scope of what I can achieve? Not anything that's too big or too grandiose. Choose something that's as small and as limited and specific as possible and deal with that. And when you've dealt with that, draw a line underneath it and then deal with the next thing. Draw a line underneath it and then deal with the next thing. So set yourself small, achievable goals and then review those goals as you go. And then that will train your mind not to get lost into doubt. Yeah. So I said there were two extremes. The most obvious extreme is being caught up in having too many doubts. But then the other extreme is when you have no doubts at all. Right? And this is the one where this is perhaps even more dangerous, because you're not going to see it as a problem. You'll see it as good, because I have lots of confidence, I have lots of faith, I just believe everything I'm told, I understand everything about the Dhamma, and I never have any doubts about it because I know exactly what's right and what's wrong. What could go wrong? If you think like that, then you're stuck. And you're going to become an absolutist and a fundamentalist. And you're going to become someone who's like super boring at parties. Okay? So don't be that guy, all right? Don't do that, please. Yeah? Don't turn Buddhism into another kind of fundamentalism. Don't even turn early Buddhism and the suttas into another kind of fundamentalism. Yeah? Doubt is a natural and a normal part of a spiritual path. Yeah? And we need to have that ability to suspend things in our mind and to not know. There's a beautiful passage in the suttas where sometimes the monks or sometimes the Buddha will go and visit a monastery of the wanderers of some other path, and they'll sit there and they'll listen, and the people will say something and they're not quite sure about it, and it says without accepting it or without rejecting it, we should go and ask and inquire of the Buddha and see what the meaning of this is. And that's a beautiful space to hold, yeah? Neither accepting nor rejecting, but I will inquire as to the meaning of it. This is This is the real way to overcome doubt, not by a false sense of certainty, not by believing that everything you read in a book is true in black and white, or believing that everything you think in your mind is true in black and white, but by having the space in your mind to be able to hold contradictory interpretations and to look at it and to realize, well, actually, things that are contradictory or that appear to me to be contradictory can be resolved in many ways. Sometimes one thing is right and the other thing is wrong. Yeah, sometimes that happens. Sometimes there's some truth to both of them. Yeah, sometimes actually neither of them are right and something else is the case. Sometimes there's a broader perspective by which you can see that actually both of those things are talking about the same thing from different angles. So somebody who has wisdom will recognize that apparent contradictions can be resolved in all of these different kinds of ways. And they're not necessarily in a hurry to resolve any particular contradiction. Like sometimes we have to be, right? Sometimes we have to resolve them. If we're driving down the road, go left or right, we have to. There's a time on that, right? We have to make that choice. But in spiritual matters, that's not always the case. And in spiritual matters, often, the reason why we can't resolve things is because we simply haven't grown enough. It's simply a question of maturity, and it takes time. And the questions and the doubts and the problems that we have when we come to the path, yes, we should ask about them and we should clarify them and so on. But a lot of those things we'll find over time will come to be resolved through wisdom. And especially when you see, oh, actually, well, these are different ways of looking at it and different ways of practicing. And so, so patience and acceptance is also a very important part of overcoming doubt. So if you are, and just one final practical thing about doubt is that specifically for your meditation, it's important to be clear at the start of every meditation, every sitting that you do, it's important to be clear at the start about what your meditation is going to be in that sitting, right? For this session, for this half an hour, or for this period that I'm sitting, for this hour, or whatever it is, I'm going to be doing breath meditation. I'm going to be doing metta meditation. And you don't just wander from one meditation to another. You don't sort of sit down there and sort of go into it, and then after 10 minutes, like, oh, here I am watching my breath. Okay? Be clear about it right from the beginning. And if you find yourself drifting from one meditation to another, stop yourself. Be mindful. Say, hang on, I was here to do this. And come back to it and do that meditation. If you start meditation and you're doing one meditation session and you're doing one kind of meditation and you discover that kind of meditation is not working, yeah, maybe you're just falling asleep or something like that, okay, then stop, mindfully stop, come out of the meditation, okay, break that meditation session, then go for a walk, have a bit of a break or whatever, and then come back and start another meditation. But don't be switching from one to another during the meditation. You're teaching yourself bad habits. So part of your mindfulness is the idea of continuity to ensure that you keep on practicing the same thing. That's not to say that when you're doing the meditation, sometimes you can structure your meditation so that you can do a few different things within the practice, like we do with metta practice. We start out with a few minutes of just bare mindfulness, and then we begin the metta practice and so on, because that's what we mean to do. That's our intention from the beginning, right? We're not just doing the mindfulness practice and then like, oh, why don't we do some metta? That's our plan from the beginning. Yeah? So that's different. That's not what I mean. But what I mean is that you shouldn't be drifting from one kind of practice to another during the one meditation session. And if you find that you are doing that a lot, then that's a good sign that there is that doubt in your mind, that lack of clarity. So keep your meditations shorter, and even remind yourself to say to yourself three times at the beginning of this meditation, for this meditation, I will watch my breath. For this meditation, I will watch my breath. For this meditation, I will watch my breath. And then they will come back to help you when you get confused or lost during the practice. Okay? So that's a few thoughts and reflections for you this morning on doubt.